Good morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices. This is the show for writers, wannabe writers, and people who just love to read books. My name is Linda Field. I'm your host. And today my guest is going to be Larry Bain, and he's going to be talking about his book called The Tour. It's about his experiences in Vietnam. I'd like to remind you that we're supported by the Calaveras County Arts Council, and this program is part of Manzanita Writers Press and Writers Unlimited, the writing group that meets in San Andreas twice a month on the second and fourth Mondays. And if you're around and you'd like to sit in on one of our meetings, just come ahead. We meet at the Art Gallery on Main Street. We park behind the gallery and enter through the back door. We'd like to certainly express a lot of gratitude to the Calaveras County Arts Council for supporting us the way they do. Okay, well, I think we ought to get started talking to our guest today because there's a lot to talk about. Larry Bain has written his book, The Tour, and it's about his one-year experience in Vietnam, I believe during the year 1968. 1967, you corrected me. And Larry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Linda. Thank you for having me.
It's really nice to have you with us. Now, Larry, how did you come to write this book? What got you started on it?
Well, most Vietnam veterans do not talk about their experiences because during the 60s and 70s, Vietnam veterans were the bad guy in society, and it was in our best interest not to say anything and to keep it quiet. So finally, I decided that my kids needed to know what I experienced, and I started writing down on some paper, and it just went off. It just, and in a matter of days, I had 100 handwritten pages and realized that there was more to write. So that's how the book got started.
So you originally started it as a letter to your kids.
That's correct. That's what I did, yeah.
Yeah, the Vietnam War was, you and I were talking on the phone the other day, and I told you that I read your book, and I'm so glad you wrote it. And for me, the Vietnam memories are emotional and tough, and I didn't even lose any loved ones over there. It was just a really hard time for, I think, the whole country to go through. It changed the nation, in my opinion. We would be a different country today had we not had that war experience that I think, well, it's kind of like a minefield, I feel, talking about it. But I'm so glad that you wrote this book because it is time. It's been way past time for us to talk about it. And you have a lot in there, a lot of great stories about just what life was like over there. The jokes that you played on each other, the way the enlisted men were treated by the officers, the discomfort you went through, so much stuff. So when you were writing this thing that started to be a letter, turned into a book, and how long did it take you to write it once you realized you were working on a book, not a letter?
I had the majority of the book written within 6 months.
It must have just poured out of you then.
It really did. It really did. I just, one memory would jog another memory, and it just kept going and going. And I was working at the time, full time, so I'd have to write it in the evenings when I got home. That's why it took 6 months.
Well, I'm working on my book now. It's in the fourth or fifth year. So if I were you, I wouldn't feel too bad about it taking 6 months. I'd say that's a wonderful amount of time to spend to get a book. So what did your kids think of it? Did you have people read it as you were working on it, or did you keep it secret until it was all finished?
Actually, I did have some people when I got it in sort of a manuscript form. I had a friend of mine read it, and he took it home, and he actually had a hardcover book made out of it, and it was really an emotional thing to get that book.
I imagine it was. What a surprise. He had a hardcover book made, just one copy, just for you.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh, how wonderful. I bet that's one of your prized possessions.
It is, yes.
Yeah. He's a good friend.
Yes, he is.
Okay, so what did your kids think of it when they read what you wrote?
You know, I get a lot of different reactions from people who read the book, and most of the reactions are no reaction at all, which surprises me to some extent.
No reaction at all? That's amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, people, it is an emotional issue.
Maybe they're afraid they'll say the wrong thing.
That's quite possible. I don't know. I don't know what they think.
Yeah, I think again, this is my own experience and my own memories of the war. Maybe people don't comment because there is so much to say, and maybe it wasn't just the guys who were over there and went through all that horrible stuff and then came back and didn't want to talk about it, but the people who stayed here find it hard to talk about as well, because I better just keep this to myself. I feel, I guess, a sense of shame over the way the veterans were treated, the guys who came back. I never would have said or done anything to insult any of them, because I knew what a hardship they'd been through. But I was not in favor of the war. And that's what I think tore this country apart, really did.
Yeah, I think you're right. It was very hard for veterans when they came back and being treated like they were. And in reality, how I actually even got into the service was, you know, I felt that it was my duty to go over there and serve.
And the really interesting thing about the fact that you thought it was your duty, you weren't even an American citizen. You're from Canada.
That's true, but I felt like I had lived in this country long enough and enjoyed its riches that I needed to serve.
Well, that was very honorable. And you were drafted. Now, what I read in the book was that you knew that you were going to be drafted. You were reclassified 1A, which, since we don't have the draft anymore, thank God, people may not know what that is, but 1A classification is you better get ready to go.
That's true. You had about 30 days to get your stuff in order and get ready to go, because you were going to be drafted.
So you signed up to be a helicopter mechanic. Interesting. So my picture of a helicopter mechanic is somebody who stays there in the base wherever the helicopters come in and take off and land, and you just stay right there in relative safety. And you fix helicopters, but that's not quite the way it was, is it?
Well, it could have been for me. I actually volunteered to be a crew chief and fly with the helicopter after about 4 months. Why I did that at this point in time, I questioned myself, but it was a valuable experience, and I survived it, and I'm glad I did it at this point. I just have reflections now.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot to reflect on. I was reading in the book about, you tell a little bit, that you've got a couple of chapters about your childhood and your going to high school. In high school, you were kind of a track star, weren't you?
Well, I wouldn't know if I'd call myself a star, but I was doing all right.
The coach, he recognized that you would be a really fast runner, and so he timed you a few times, and pretty soon you were moved up on the track team and in competitions and everything, and you were winning a lot of those competitions.
I was winning some of them, but, you know, it's a matter of conditioning, and I enjoyed running, so it wasn't that hard for me, and it was in my family blood, so it worked
out.
Because
your dad?
My dad was a national champion of Canada, and I think it was 1933 in the mile and half mile. And my brother was a track star in high school, and he got a scholarship to the University of Washington when he was graduated from high school. So, like I said, it was in my blood.
Well, I want our listeners to hang on to that idea that it was in your blood to be a runner, and you were a good one. And yet, when you got to basic training, you had a really pretty bad experience, and I was shocked when I read it. So stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back with more from Larry Bain talking about his book, The Tour. Okay, Larry Bain and I were talking during the break about the fact that we don't want to sound like we're tearing down the military at all. I don't want to do that because I love this country, and our military helps us keep this country. I really want to stress that. And Larry has a lot he'd like to say about the public perception back then during the Vietnam War.
Well, every war has its problems. As we go, for example, Vietnam, the time I was over there, we had no news of things that were going on in the war, even. They came out with the Stars and Stripes paper, which, of course, you're only going to hear what the military wants you to hear, and you really don't get the full truth of what goes on. I do know that in terms of body counts, which to the military, that's a big thing. They don't want to have a battle where there's more of us killed than the other guys, so consequently, I know that the lies were told about body counts, but my point of this whole conversation was that we get judged as a person in a war or as a veteran by what happened over there, and most of which we had no control over, and it's very easy for people here at home to sit and judge what goes on, and you're only because of our newspapers and...
Yeah, we had the Vietnam War in our living rooms every night on television.
That's true, and most of those guys were never in a dangerous situation. I can remember being filmed coming into an LZ, a landing zone, and we were told that the cameras were there, so knowing that it was totally safe and you didn't have to be on the machine gun, you could stand up on the gun mount, and anyway, we got judged by what happened, even though in most cases, we didn't even know what had happened. The My Lai Massacre, for example. I didn't learn about that until probably a year after I was back, and I believe it happened sometime in 1968, which I got back in early 68. You know, a lot of terrible things happened to our guys that never got published. When the enemy got a hold of them, they'd be better off to shoot themselves before they got a hold of them, because they did terrible things to them, and you don't hear about that.
You were just trying to stay alive.
Yeah, basically, when you get over there or get into a war zone, it's just a matter of survival. Fight for your country, but you're fighting to survive. Well, we only see one side of it. We don't have reporters in with the Al-Qaeda and whoever else we're fighting over there. We don't have them in there showing what they do to our people. And so we just get one side of it. And normally all this stuff that comes out is after the fact. The facts themselves are not really known. But I think the media likes to sell papers and sell their television shows, and they do that through sensationalism. And that's what happened. And the soldiers get made the bad guy for it.
Just thinking about the temperatures, the high temperatures that they have to deal with over there, and seeing the uniforms that they're wearing, all the equipment they have to carry, I think I'd just drop dead from heat and exhaustion without having to worry about any roadside bombs or anything else.
Yeah, and the crazy part is that we send our young men just out of high school into these situations, and we expect them to act like they did at the prom.
Yeah. Let's lighten it up a little bit. Why don't you tell me about the Coke attack?
Well, the Coke attack happened. My friend and I, he and I were sent down to the coast to pick up some material, and I was driving a deuce and a half, a 2.5-ton truck, which I didn't know how to drive at the time. They just issued me a license and sent me on my way. But this was actually the second trip that I was on to go down there, so I did get the hang of it. But anyway, we're down at the coast, and normally we look for a convoy to form up to, because we had a steep mountain pass to go up, and we needed to be in a convoy for safety, but...
Because the trucks go so slowly when they go uphill, right?
Oh, this, yeah, they'd only do about 5 miles an hour going up this pass, but...
Boy, sitting targets.
Oh, absolutely, but the thing was, the military, they sent us down there. They didn't tell us where convoys formed up or when. So we're down there, and we realized we have to get back, or they'd be after us. So we decided we'd just take off and go, and just one single truck, the two of us, going up this mountain pass, which, by the way, the trip was about 100 miles. So anyway, we're going up this mountain pass. We're doing about 5 miles an hour, and going around one particular curve, I spotted two soldiers, and they both had rifles, and they're walking along, one on each side of the road. And I didn't know whether they were friendlies or unfriendlies. I couldn't tell. They did not look like American soldiers, so I was quite nervous about the whole situation. As we got closer and closer, they turned around and faced us, and they didn't point their guns at us, but they signaled for us to stop. So I stopped and realized that they were Orientals, but I didn't know from what country. And so I didn't shoot us, so I figured, well, maybe they're friendly. So they indicated that they wanted a ride, so they jumped on the running boards of the truck, one on each side. Of course, they had to sling their rifle, so they were not able to shoot us from that position. So off we went, going up this mountain pass, and I guess it was about 10 miles they rode on the running boards, and we finally came into this village, and I crossed this bridge, and came to a stop. He indicated he wanted to stop, and I realized that they were the South Koreans. And they had an emplacement there, so they jumped off the truck when I'd stopped, and I noticed that they had foxholes and bunkers and right at the river. But the instant the guy on my side had his feet hit the ground from jumping off the running board, there was an explosion, and it was really close, and it rocked the truck. So I yelled to my friend, I said, "Dick, we're being mortared." So I shoved that truck in gear, and I had it flying down a highway, which was full of potholes. So it looked like a horse running on a track, because the tires would only occasionally touch the ground. And we were doing, I don't know how fast we were going. The speedometer only went to 60, and it was pegged. We got to a small town, and I had a terrible thirst from that whole episode. And I stopped, and my friend, he went to one of the local establishments to find something to drink. But I had bought a can of Coke when I was at the coast, and I had set it up on the canvas top of this truck right behind my seat. And I started looking for it, and it wasn't under the seat. It wasn't where I put it. And I looked on the other side of the truck. It wasn't there. And finally started checking around underneath the truck, and there, wedged between the spare tire and the exhaust manifold, was this can of Coke with the end blown out of it. And apparently what had happened is that as I stopped at the bridge, it had heated up and exploded, and that was the explosion that caused all the ruckus.
That was your mortar attack.
That was it.
Oh, good. At least sometimes things that seemed really dangerous were not that bad. You had some other really close calls, though. Oh, my goodness. There was one. You were just a short time from being sent home. And when we come back, I want you to tell about that experience. You had to take one more flight. So, Larry, you were, there's a section in your book called the Snoopy Mission. You want to tell us what they were?
Well, the Snoopy machine was a machine that was mounted inside the helicopter, and it had a tube that went outside and was mounted on the bottom of the helicopter that picked up the scent of ammonia and smoke. And so our mission, when we're flying a Snoopy mission, was to fly at treetop level. And if there were any enemy troops in the area, if they were sweating a lot, which they probably were, then it would pick up the ammonia scent, or if they had a campfire going or whatever, then it would pick up the smoke. These missions were flown, as I said, at treetop level, and most of them were flown in the Dokto area, which was very mountainous and very dangerous. So it created numerous instances that were close calls.
So rockets and mortars could hit your helicopter. It was a pretty dangerous situation.
Yes, it was. It was a dangerous mission, and we'd already lost one of our crew chiefs from this mission. And one instance that happened to us, and that was flying the Dokto area, and as I said, it was very mountainous. So when we got to the top of a mountain, the helicopter would be going really slow, so the pilot would drop the collective stick and give it some hard right or left pedal and side flip down the mountain, and we'd pick up airspeed. But at the top of the mountain, we'd probably be doing maybe 20 knots, which is very slow and made us an easy target. But one particular instance, we were out of the mountains and we started flying level in a valley, and I heard something hit the ship. And I looked ahead, and there were two men squatted down with AK-47s firing at us. So I turned the machine gun and started firing at them. And, we're doing 120 miles an hour, so things happened quickly. In just a few seconds, we were past them. And I stood out on the gun mount, still trying to fire at them. And
is this outside the helicopter?
Yes. It was not something I regularly did, but the adrenaline was going, I guess, and anyway, I was glad there was a stop on the machine gun because I probably would have shot the tail boom of the helicopter. Anyway, we went past them and the pilot started to pull pitch to get us some altitude. An engine chip detector light came on and that worried him. He thought maybe we had taken a round to the engine. So he radioed that in to the infantry guy that was in charge, telling him that we'd have to end the mission because we were just shot at. And anyway, his reaction was, oh, I thought they were there. So we were basically the guinea pigs for a mission that they thought the enemy troops were around. So
you were really, without knowing it, you were kind of being sent there to smoke them out and find out if there was really enemy there.
Yes, and to make matters worse, he wanted to know what they were wearing. And my temptation was to tell him that the guy had on leopard skin leotards and purple polka dots. But they didn't accept that, so they wanted to know what they were really wearing.
What difference would it make? I guess it was hard sometimes. Well, I know in Vietnam it was very hard to tell the difference between the enemy and the friendlies at different times. Is that why he wanted to know what they were wearing?
Well, they were definitely not friendlies. What they wore basically told our infantry what unit they were with, whether they were North Vietnamese or whether they were Viet Cong, or what their clothes were was very important to them.
Was there much of a difference to you guys who were being shot at, whether they were North Vietnamese or Viet Cong? What was the difference?
It didn't make any difference if you were being shot at. You had to return fire and try and survive.
And you had a really difficult situation that I think our military now in Afghanistan is facing. You were not allowed to fire unless you were fired on first, right?
That's correct. That happened later on in the tour, but I had one instance where we passed some troops, and for some reason I didn't see them. Initially, the pilot asked me if I saw them, and I told him no. So he turned around and went back, and there were between 50 and 75 troops out in the open in a field, and so luckily they didn't fire on us. And my question was, did they all have to fire for me to return fire, or just a few? So I didn't know what the policy was on that. I was being sort of facetious in there and annoyed with the policy, so that was my comment.
Yeah, I can understand that. Now, we hear a lot about Agent Orange. What was your experience and exposure to it over there?
Well, actually, our helicopters sprayed the stuff. Not all of them, but there was one particular one that I know did. The crew chief was in my platoon, so I knew him very well. And I know that he had effects from the Agent Orange just dealing with it and flying with the chopper that sprayed it.
Did you keep in contact with him afterwards? Do you know how he is now?
I haven't, no. Most of the guys I served with, I have no contact with at this point. There is one or two that I do.
I suppose it's just natural as life carries on. You're back here stateside and living in peace, thank heaven, and your life just goes on.
Yeah, it's hard to locate them after this period of time. And to tell you the truth, there's a lot of Vietnam veterans that are passing at this time, and it seems premature to me because I'm such a young fellow, but it seems to be going on.
Now, Korea is known for Pork Chop Hill. Vietnam had a hill 875. What can you tell us about that?
Hill 875 was in the Dok Tho area, and normally what happened was that during the monsoons, we would evacuate the area because we couldn't resupply the troops because the clouds would be down on the mountain. And so the enemy would come in and take it over and dig in bunkers and tunnels and what have you. And they would occupy it. And the following spring, we would try and take it back, and always with a great loss of life. And in my opinion, any loss of one American life is too many, but that particular hill cost hundreds of lives.
And it had to be retaken every year.
That, from my short experience being 1 year, that was what I got out of it.
Mm. And I'm sure there were lots of other places like that as well. Now, this is jungle, and when I think of jungle, I get all creepy and creepy feeling. And my brother Bill Taylor, back home in Salamanca, New York, Bill was in Vietnam. He was in the Navy. And he had a picture on his Facebook page for a long time. I finally asked him to remove it. It's a picture that was taken of him in Vietnam where he's got this snake draped around his shoulders. It's a really long snake. And I love wildlife, but snakes and I have had a difficult time in my lifetime. I really have a hard time warming up to them. Did you encounter any wildlife when you were over there, and was it creepy? Or, well, you're a farm boy. You probably took it in stride.
Actually, because I was in the air most of the time, we didn't really encounter any wildlife. Other than, I can tell you that we were flying to that Dok Tho area one time, and I was at the machine gun and looking out, of course, watching diligently. And I saw a couple of Bengal tigers that were laying at the edge of a clearing, and that was an awesome sight.
I bet it was. I just love tigers. I can relate to them a whole lot better than I can a long snake. Okay, we'll be back in just a few minutes with a little bit more from Larry about his experiences in Vietnam, and we'll hear something from the book, too. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We're here talking with Larry Bain about his book, The Tour, his account of the year that he spent in Vietnam. And I just wanted to point out again that there is a really good map of Vietnam on the back of the book, on the back cover. It's in full color. It lists all the places that we heard about so much on the news back when the war was going on. And so if you are interested in learning more about the Vietnam War, because so many people who are hearing the show weren't around when this was going on, this book is it'd be a good resource for you. And at the back, Larry has put some statistics, and I'd like you to think about the war we're fighting now. So compare these statistics that I'm going to read to what's going on in our war today. You'll see maybe how different it was. Just make your comparisons when you hear these statistics. In the Vietnam War, 2,700,918 Americans served in Vietnam. This number represents 9.7% of their generation. That's 2,700,000 709,918. That's a huge number. The total deaths were 58,202, and this includes men who were formerly classified as MIA, missing in action. It also includes men who have subsequently died of wounds, and so the number is continuing to go up. 61% of the men killed were 21 years old or younger, and wounded, 303,704. Missing in action, 2,338. Do we have any missing in action in this war?
I do not know.
You know, we don't hear about it.
No.
POWs, 766 of our men were prisoners of war in the Vietnam War, and 114 of those died in captivity. And as of January 15, 2004, there were still 1,875 American men still unaccounted for from the Vietnam War. Those statistics are astounding. All war is terrible, but the Vietnam War was a really painful experience for everybody. Larry, there's another difference, and I didn't warn you ahead of time that I was going to ask this, but I think you'll probably know. I think I know the answer right off the top of my head. Were there any women involved? Did you work alongside any women when you were in Vietnam?
No, actually, we rarely saw any women, and the only ones I can think of were girls that they called donut dollies, and they were Red Cross workers that would show up occasionally. But I was flying most of the time, so I didn't see very many people. I hardly knew what was going on at our own base. Say there were women there. Yes, there were, but I sure didn't see them.
And that is another difference today, because we have women soldiers in combat. Lots of changes. Now everybody hears about Agent Orange because it was used so much during the Vietnam War. And you have a little paragraph about it in your book. You were talking about your friend Jim, who was the crew chief for the 3rd Platoon, which is the platoon that you were in. And tell us about what he experienced with Agent Orange.
Well, they actually would spray that stuff daily. And, of course, he told me that the Army told him that it was safe to use and no problem with it. So they'd go out and spray jungle and areas around where our camp was on a daily basis. And he started noticing that he started getting sores on his body. And he was convinced that it was from Agent Orange. Of course, you know, we didn't know at the time what the consequences were. So, you know, he had to live with that. And unfortunately, I have been out of touch with almost everybody I was in Vietnam with, except for a few, so I don't know whether they are still alive or not.
Mm-hmm. You did get to see the countryside after Agent Orange was sprayed. What changes were there in the countryside from Agent Orange?
Well, actually, they used C-130s as well to spray that stuff, and they could spray a lot more of it in a lot wider area, so you could see a path where Agent Orange had been sprayed, and the leaves were all dead, you know, compared to a typical jungle where everything is bright green or a lively green. And it's definitely something you could see.
So it killed all the plant life. And, of course, the reason for that, for using the Agent Orange, was that there were so many enemy patrols going through the jungles that it was really hard for our troops to know where they were traveling. So that was the reason given for using the defoliant. It's really a defoliant. There was a nice little bit in your book. I'm going to read it. It's very short. Every once in a while in life, we may get to witness something very few people have ever seen. Such was the case one trip, flying low level on our way to Dak Tho. As we came to a clearing, my eyes were fixed on the tree line. With machine gun at the ready, at the tree line were two Bengal tigers lying at the edge of a clearing. I asked the pilot if he saw them. He said he didn't, and we turned the ship around to have a look, but by then, they were gone. I hope those tigers got through the war okay. Can you imagine wildlife like that living with all everything else going on, let alone what was happening with the people.
Yeah, it was quite an experience. You know, I can still picture that in my mind, and unfortunately no one else got to see it but me. So just one of those things that you know, makes for good memories in life.
Yeah. It's nice to know that you could have a good memory coming out of a war. And I'm sure you have a lot of them. What's your favorite memory from your service in Vietnam? Do you have one?
Because I like humor, I think my favorite one was the Coke incident.
Oh, yes. We heard about that one when the Coke can exploded.
Yeah, and that, you know, I felt like a fool afterwards, but, you know, sometimes that happens. You get into situations where you don't exactly know what's going on, and that was the case there, where I thought we were being mortared. And
it sure makes for a funny story. Kind of the joke was on you. Now, Larry, we are almost out of time, but there was one time I mentioned that there was one last flight that you had to take that that turned out to be pretty dramatic, and it had to do with, now the Huey helicopters that you worked on flew different ways at different altitudes, and there were lots of altitude changes in Vietnam, low valleys, high mountains, and you experienced all of that. It could be kind of dangerous. Could you tell a little bit about why?
Well, the first helicopters that we had there were D models, D as in Delta, and they had an 1,100 horsepower turbine engine, and they did not work well at high altitude. They just didn't have the power for it, and we had occasions where we got into very dangerous situations because the power, the ship would actually lose power and start coming down. So there's one incident that, in my book about that. And
when it lost power and was not able to climb, it was also flying pretty slowly and made you a good target for people who were on the ground firing at you, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it gets to be pretty hairy when you're in a jungle situation you know, you start clipping trees, you don't know whether you're going to make it or not. Yeah, it gets a little lively.
That's right. And you've got people at eye level on the ground with guns. Now, there was another time you had a really close call where you were in a helicopter that landed in a wooded area. Why don't you tell us about that one?
Well, we were dropping off some long-range reconnaissance patrols, and it was actually four guys, and three of them were Vietnamese, and one of them was an American. And anyway, we dropped them off, and as the American jumped out last, he had the radio on his back, and his radio hit my radio switch, which is unreachable for me in the cubby that I sat at with the machine gun. Anyway, he put it on the private, and he jumped out.
He put the radio on private? What does that mean?
Well, it means that no one else can hear you unless their radio is on private. So the net result was that I couldn't talk to the pilot and co-pilot and tell them what the situation was from my side of the ship. And as it turned out, there was a big tree that was dead about 10 o'clock position ahead of us, and our rotor blades were about a foot from it. And anyway, because of the way we landed, we were going to head out right through that tree unless they saw it and moved. And I couldn't tell them about it, so we ended up hitting the tree, the tree exploded, and all kinds of things were happening at that point in time. They couldn't, the pilot couldn't control the ship. The lurks thought that they were being shot at, so they wanted to come back.
What are lurks?
Long-range reconnaissance patrol.
Oh.
They wanted
our guys?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
The ones we just dropped off.
Yeah.
They thought they were being shot at, so they wanted to come back and be picked up. And like I say, the pilot couldn't control the ship, so he started yelling Mayday. And luckily, one of the pilots had been a Green Beret and had coolness about him, so he took control, and we flew low level back to our base.
Wow, so you did make it. Well, obviously you made it out of there, but without any great catastrophe. That's great. Larry, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It's been fascinating talking with you. I hope that people have gotten a lot out of this program, and you'll get a lot out of your book. It's called The Tour. It's available, once again, tell us how to get it.
It's available on Amazon. It's $9.99.
Okay. Larry Bain, The Tour. Thanks for being with us today. Hope you enjoyed the program, and I look forward to seeing you again next week. Have a good week.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.